from the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Jody Heiss.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Jody Heiss, senior fellow here at the Family Research Council. An honor today to be filling in for Tony. We've got a lot to bring your way today. Here are some of the headlines that we'll be discussing. President Trump made it clear today that the National Guard will be on their way to Chicago, in spite of the fact that the mayor there claims that the people of Chicago don't need protection from crime, but from law enforcement who prevent crime, like what we've seen in D.C.
We have seen with the surge in the last 30 days in Washington, D.C., that law enforcement on the streets works. We know that. This is common sense. The mayors and the governors need to step up in places like Chicago, L.A., Atlanta, other places. They need to step up and they need to start protecting their citizens and not protecting the criminals.
That was Congresswoman Harriet Hageman earlier today while she was leading a press conference on the crime crackdown in D.C. Congressman Buddy Carter was also there, and he will be joining me here in just a few moments with the latest on the crime crackdown and the Democrats' resistance to it all. And then there is this announcement.
7 years in the making. As you know, this has been going on for a long period of time, and I am thrilled to report that the U.S. Space Command headquarters will move to the beautiful locale of a place called Huntsville, Alabama, forever to be known from this point forward as Rocket City.
Well, that was President Trump earlier today, and I'll be discussing this a little bit later in the program when I'm joined by former Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks. And then in another announcement that's been making waves is President Trump's social media post on a forthcoming executive order to make voter ID a requirement for voting. Cleta Mitchell from the Election Integrity Network will join me a little bit later to unpack that. And then lastly, there has been quite a bit of news on the economic side. In fact, on this past Friday, a federal appeals court ruled that most of President Trump's tariffs are illegal.
If the lower court's ruling is upheld, President Trump has correctly said that will be the end of the United States because it will be impossible to defend ourselves from the fentanyl poisoning and all of the trade environment, which is hollowing out our supply chains and creating very dangerous problems for the American people.
That was White House Senior Counselor for Trade and Manufacturing, Peter Navarro, speaking to reporters yesterday. I'll discuss this and some other developments on the economic front when I'm joined later today by Dr. Jason Sorens. He's over at the American Institute for Economic Research. So as usual, we've got a packed program coming your way in the next hour. You don't want to miss any of it, but if by chance you do, you want to check out TonyPerkins.com, our website. And better yet, I encourage you just to download our Stand Firm app. Not only this program, a host of others and tons of resources available, tons of resources on our Stand Firm app. You can simply text the word app, APP, to 67742 if you don't yet have the Stand Firm app. Go get it. Also, don't forget about our upcoming Pray Vote Stand Summit. It's coming up October 17th and 18th. In Chino Hills, California. Again, you can visit the following website for more details, and that is PrayVoteStand.org. PrayVoteStand.org. All right, let's jump into our first item for today. Over the weekend, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson signed a sweeping executive order supposedly protecting Chicago from the possibility of the federal government's National Guard deployment into the city. And now it's looking like that's more than just a possibility, as President Trump actually told reporters earlier today that he will be sending the National Guard to Chicago. after what success we've seen in Chicago, he says, in Washington, D.C., he says Chicago is next. But he did not say when that would happen. So how might all of this play out? Joining me now to discuss this and more is Congressman Buddy Carter. He serves on the House Budget Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee. He represents the first congressional district of the great state of Georgia. Congressman Carter, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to see you.
Always good to see you, my friend.
All right, so you were at the press conference today, and in fact, you spoke there regarding the federal government's crackdown on crime in Washington, D.C. It has clearly been a success, hasn't it?
Oh, there's no question about it. Jody, I was at Union Station on Sunday, and it was so nice to see the National Guard there, to see just how nice it was to be able to enjoy what is obviously a very beautiful area, a very beautiful building. And that's what the president has done. Remember, he campaigned and promised that he was going to make America more prosperous and more safer. And he has done just that. He's made it more prosperous through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Now he's making it safer by doing what he's doing here and making our streets safer here in Washington, D.C. and throughout our country. Remember, Jody, I was mayor at one time, and I understood just how important it was to keep our citizens safe. It should be that way for every mayor. It just baffles me, and it disappoints me so much to hear Chicago, particularly those who are supposed to be setting an example, saying they don't want help in fighting crime. I mean, why wouldn't you want your citizens to be safe? I don't get that at all.
Yeah, I don't get it either. It's just absolutely stunning to me. In fact, they have the attitude that instead of protecting their citizens from crime, they're going to protect their citizens from law enforcement who are there to prevent crime. Like you said, it's just stunning to me. So what do you think, though, about the president moving from Washington, D.C., where clearly he does have constitutional authority to intervene in what happens in Washington, D.C., but there are some question marks, are there not, to going to other cities, be it Chicago or New York or wherever else?
You're right, but I applaud the president for what he's doing. The president is taking charge here. He campaigned and he promised he was going to make America safer. He was going to make it more prosperous, and he's doing just that. And, you know, people ask me, and the Democrats want to make this out to be that he's picking on them. If you'll remember the bank robber, Willie Sutton, they asked him one time, why do you rob banks? And his answer was, because that's where they keep the money. Well, why are you picking these cities? Because that's where the problem is. It's in Chicago. It's in Baltimore. It's because of ineffective and weak leadership, Democratic leadership, that we're seeing these crime-ridden cities. Look at what he's done in Washington, D.C. We had a serious problem in Washington, D.C. Earlier this summer, we had two embassy workers killed at the Israeli embassy. Earlier this year, we had an intern here from Capitol Hill who was shot and killed. We had a member of the administration who was mugged and brutally beaten. We needed him to interact or to get into and bring that stability here. And he did just that. And I'm proud of the president for doing that. I feel safer now in Washington, D.C. And people in Chicago, people in Baltimore, they deserve to have safe streets. They deserve to be able to go out to dinner with their family without worrying about crime.
Yeah, I agree, and it feels so good walking about and seeing the National Guard, and I have yet to speak with anyone, Uber drivers or whomever, that were offended by the fact that they are safer. If I can switch gears, in spite of the fact, and I'm going to have to run on from that topic, but I'm sure you saw Judge Charles Breyer in California have said that the president violated the law by going to California to prevent crime. So we're still going to see more of this come up, Congressman Carter. But if I can, let me slip by you. What do you make about the Democrats' resistance to all of this? Do you see that with your colleagues in the House, the Democrats, that they are indeed resistant to prevention of crime?
Well, they are, and we've seen it. Jody, it was going on while you were still a member here. This, defund the police movement, and it seems like they were more concerned about protecting the criminal than they were about protecting citizens from crime. And that's something that just baffles me, and I just don't, I don't get it, because the Democrats just don't understand. They're always on the 20% side of the 80-20 rule, and it just is not working for them. But we all want safe cities. I don't care what an ethnicity you are. You want to be able to go out to eat with your family and not have to worry about crime. You want to be able to walk down the sidewalk and not have to worry about being badgered by someone. So that these are the kind of things that the president's addressing, and these are the kind of things that need to be addressed in our country, in our big cities especially.
Don't you think it largely comes down to just, as many refer to as Trump derangement syndrome, there's just a utmost hatred for President Trump, to the extent that if he is for something, they automatically are going to be against it, even if it is something that is good for their own citizens, their own states and cities and constituents and so forth, like preventing crime? It's become a partisan issue because Trump is in favor of it.
And it should not be a partisan issue. I don't care whether you're white, black, Hispanic, whatever. You want to be safe in your city. When I was mayor, I wanted to make sure my citizens were safe. And you could not be more right about this Trump derangement syndrome. I'm convinced that the 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration, all they did was go in there and said, whatever Donald Trump did the previous 4 years, we're going to do just the opposite. He wanted to shut down our border. We're going to make sure that we're open that border. And that's what they did. And it led to all of this unrest and all of this mess that we've got now that we're trying to clean up. And thank goodness the president is cleaning that up. But you're right. Who wouldn't want a safe city? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, and, even over the weekend, to go further with that, I'm sure you saw over the Labor Day weekend in many major cities, there were protests held, anti-Trump protests, with the theme, workers over billionaires. What was your take on those protests, as we'll call them?
Workers over billionaires, yeah. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act that saved taxpayers $3,000 a year. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act that did away with tax on tips, that did away with tax on overtime. Yeah, those billionaires, they're getting a lot of tips. They're getting a lot of overtime. Yeah, it was favoring billionaires, all right. Makes no sense whatsoever. The One Big Beautiful Bill benefited the middle class worker more than it did anyone. And to say that, just because the president's been very successful and he's done well in business and he is a billionaire, I think is, again, what you pointed out earlier, just part of the Trump derangement syndrome.
We've only got, real quickly, 30 seconds or so, but Congress is back in session. What do you think are going to be the main topics that you try to tackle in the next couple
of
weeks?
Well, we've got to do something about the budget, as you know. Our budget year runs out September the 30th, so we've got to address that. We've got an appropriations bill on the floor tomorrow that I hope will get passed. But, if the Democrats do not cooperate, and if they continue to throw obstacles in this and the government shuts down, this will be the Schumer shutdown. There's no question about that.
Yes, it will. Thank you, Congressman Buddy Carter of Georgia. Always great to see you. Go get him. You got a lot on your plate.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, coming up, President Trump has finally put to rest the question over where the headquarters for the U.S. Space Command will be. And we'll talk about that decision right after the break. Stay with us.
3 years ago, the Supreme Court issued its historic Dobbs decision, a ruling that overturned Roe versus Wade, which for nearly 50 years imposed abortion on demand, silencing voters and bypassing the democratic process across the country. The Dobbs decision was a huge step forward against abortion, but it didn't outright ban it. It returned the power to the people. Now, 29 states have laws on the books protecting life. However, there's a catch. Abortion numbers since Dobbs have actually gone up, with an increase of 12% since 2020, climbing from 930,000 to over 1 million in each of the most recent years. So how can this be? The answer is simple: the abortion drug. Today, over 60% of U.S. abortions involve abortion drugs, many of these without medical oversight. In 2021, the Biden administration quietly removed bare minimum long-standing safety protocols for the abortion drug that have existed for 20 years to protect women from life-threatening risks and ensuring informed consent. The Biden DOJ then declared that they would not enforce the Comstock Act, which prevents the mailing of anything that causes an abortion. This is not only illegal, but also dangerous. A study shows nearly 11% of women who take the abortion drug end up in the emergency room with serious complications. Unless the Trump administration reverses these reckless Biden-era policies, pro-life laws will remain largely symbolic. Without a full review and repeal of mifepristone, unborn lives will remain in grave danger and pregnant mothers will remain at risk. Let's stand for life and end this mail-order abortion drug pipeline. Sign the petition urging the Trump administration to take action at frc.org/stopchemicalabortion.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Family Research Council invites you to join our Stand on the Word Bible reading plan as we reflect upon the life of Jesus, the Word who dwelt among us. Come with us and discover the glory of the Word. Read the Gospels and witness the life-changing story of Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection. Come read how Jesus transformed the lives of common people and how those same people transformed the known world through the power of the Holy Spirit. Come with us for 10 to 15 minutes a day and read the entire New Testament before the new year. Find our Bible reading plan and daily devotionals from Tony Perkins at frc.org/Bible. Join us and stand on the Word.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Jody Heiss filling in today for Tony. So glad to have you with us. All right, earlier this afternoon, President Trump announced that the U.S. Space Command is going to be moving their headquarters from U.S. Space Command from Colorado to Alabama. This reverses a former decision from President Biden not to relocate the headquarters, which actually was a plan that President Trump had during the final days of his first term. So what can we expect as the president's original plans now move forward? Well, joining me now to discuss this is former Congressman Mo Brooks. He served Alabama's 5th Congressional District for more than a decade. And while in Congress, he was part of the Armed Services Committee as well as the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. Mo, welcome back to Washington Watch. Long time no see. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Jody. It's always good to see a friend from our days in the United States Congress where we worked together, and a fellow conservative. Unfortunately, there aren't enough of us right in Washington right now.
That's a fact. But listen, I remember having many conversations with you on multiple topics, but one of them was the Space Command. And you actually taught me a lot about Huntsville and what is already in place there. I want to get to some of that here in just a moment. But first of all, give me your overall reaction to the news from the president on this.
Well, I'm elated that finally, once again, we have another presidential decision that recognizes that the Redstone Arsenal, which neighbors Huntsville, Alabama, is the superior location for Space Command. I'm a little bit disappointed that President Trump took 8 months to get this done. It was one of the things that he announced he was going to do back in January of 2021, right before he left office. But it was consistent with and in accord with a competition that had taken place. And the United States Air Force had determined that Redstone Arsenal here in the Tennessee Valley of Alabama was the superior place to locate Space Command because of all the things that we already do. You know, we're called the Rocket City. And what that means is Huntsville, Alabama, Redstone Arsenal, Marshall Space Flight Center, we're pretty much the birthplace of America's space program. You know, all those gee whiz bang weapons that you see that the military uses on a regular basis, particularly those that go through the United States Army. They're all purchased through Redstone Arsenal here in the Tennessee Valley, every single one of them, for the use by the United States Army. Plus, we are the ones that have the physicists, the scientists, the engineers that, to a very large degree, either oversee the next technological breakthrough in weaponry, or in fact, actually invent that next breakthrough that gives our warfighters a better capability of prevailing against our adversaries. So you put all these things in place that we already have established at Redstone Arsenal, and it only makes sense that you would also cite Space Command because of our leadership with NASA, Marshall Space Flight Center, combined with our leadership and so many high-tech weapon systems and platforms that we are renowned for having invented or managed or built.
Yeah, that is the type of information that I remember talking to you about. And to be very honest with you, I had no clue of the depth of the brain power and innovation that existed right there. So I'm so glad that you brought that up. Now, I'm sure you probably saw or at least heard a Department of Defense Inspector General report that was released in April, could not identify why former President Biden chose Colorado over Alabama. And in all frankness, the main reason I've heard was that it would be too costly to move. But that is not strategic thinking, is it?
Well, not at all. First, over the long haul, our community is a much cheaper, less expensive to the taxpayer place to locate Space Command. We've got workers who are available at lower cost. We've got housing that is available at lower cost. We have lower taxes that are burdening citizens in the state of Alabama than we have, say, in a place like Colorado. And so the cost argument is a false one. But where we were excelling and where we are unmatched is the technological capabilities that we have in our community. By way of just one example, we have more engineers per capita in this metropolitan area than any place in the United States. We have physicists and scientists just all around, okay? And that kind of intellectual talent, that synergy, when you put it all together, clearly made, according to the people who are making the decision now, the people who weren't involved in the politics, clearly made Redstone Arsenal, Huntsville, Alabama, the premier location to go. But give credit where credit is due. Colorado did not want to lose jobs. They were focusing on jobs, not national defense, but jobs. And they didn't want to see the potential loss of jobs or prestige go from Colorado to the state of Alabama. So they pulled out all stops. Now, it was to the detriment of the United States of America and our defense capabilities that the congressional delegation from Colorado, in conjunction with Joe Biden, reversed a merit-based decision, but give credit where credit is due. They did it for political reasons, and they were successful at achieving their goal, at least for some temporary point in time. But we cannot continue to fetter away time. Communist China is not waiting. They're building superior weaponry, even as you and I speak. And we cannot.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. We've only got about a minute left. But yeah, some people don't realize the significance of this, but this is a significant move, particularly as you just referenced, be it China or Russia increasingly looking at space for military competition. This is a strategic move.
Absolutely. Joe Biden and the Colorado delegation set us back 3 or 4 years by the political games that we played. But we've got to get our act together, and we've got to do what is necessary to adequately protect and promote our assets in space, or else we risk losing those kinds of assets. And people may not realize it, but probably close to 80 to 90% of the weaponry that the United States of America uses, our advanced weaponry, is reliant upon space platforms for location capabilities, to ensure that that weapon hits what you actually want it to hit. Our global positioning satellite system, by way of example, not just the one that the public has access to, but also the ones that are more sophisticated that are for military
use. We're going to have to wrap up.
We got to protect them.
We're going to have to wrap up there.
All right.
Former Congressman Mo Brooks from Alabama, great seeing you. It's an honor to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us. All right, friends, coming up, President Trump wants IDs to be required for anyone who votes, and he has an executive order to make that a reality. We'll cover it right after the break. Stay with us.
Download the new Stand Firm app for Apple and Android phones today. You can join a wonderful community of fellow believers. We've created a special place for you to access news from a biblical perspective. Read and listen to daily devotionals, pray for current events, and more. Share the Stand Firm app with your friends, family, and church members. And of course, stand firm wherever you go.
At Family Research Council, defending the family isn't just a mission, it's our daily calling. Every team member at FRC uses their God-given talents to stand for biblical truth, protect life, and uphold religious freedom.
Here at Family Research Council, we face many threats to the family, threats that have been with us for some time. Abortion, the gender ideology threat, the attacks on marriage, the attacks on parental authority, and the attacks on religious freedom. We have to promote, support, strengthen, and incentivize family growth so families take their place in society in a place of honor.
I'm defending the family by working in the Center for Biblical Worldview to provide cutting-edge research and resources for pastors, ministry leaders, and Christian parents.
Through my work at the Washington Stand, I passionately defend what God has defined for marriage and family. I don't see the Washington Stand as just a place to talk about cultural events. It's a place to share biblical truth. It's a perfect outlet to advance and defend what God has defined as good, true, and beautiful.
Because of you, we're able to frame things in such a way that help Christians stand for truth on the things that matter most, like life, faith, family, and freedom.
Thank you for standing with us.
Thank you for your support. It is so critical to the work that we at Family Research Council are doing day to day as we support and strengthen the family. So thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today to Washington Watch. I'm Jody Heiss, filling in today for Tony. Thank you for joining us as well. All right, over the weekend, President Trump renewed his push for election integrity efforts. He shared on a social media post that he's putting forward an executive order to make voter ID requirements for every vote. Now, given that a federal judge back in June, I believe it was, struck down part of an executive order that required proof of citizenship to vote, how might the president now approach all of this and move forward? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Cleta Mitchell. She's a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partner Institute and founder of the Election Integrity Network. Cleta, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to have you.
Thank you so much, Jody. It's always great to be with you.
All right, so let's talk about, I just mentioned it, introducing you. We have voter ID on the one hand, we have proof of citizenship, but when we talk about an executive order like this, are we talking about the same things?
Well, we're talking about slightly different things. I mean, obviously, one of the things that the Election Integrity Network is working on is making sure that voter ID, or any ID that is used for voting, should have a photo of the bearer, and it should also be one that clearly says this person is a citizen. So that's aspirational. Look, I mean, I think that there are some areas in which the president can issue an executive order under existing law. One would be under overseas people who vote, deployed military and overseas citizens. The president has authority to appoint a designee to enforce that, and all of those are federal ballots, and we know that there have been subject to there was an Iranian group in 2020 that we recently saw a report issued presented to Senator Grassley, where a group of Iranians had hacked into Alaska's voter registration database and had a whole plan to flood that state's ballots or ballot boxes with fake ballots from overseas. So we know the president has authority to do that. And I do think that the fact that there are so many states that do require, about half the states do require some form of identification. And I think that that would give authority to the president to say, to vote in a federal election, it has to meet these standards. But look, I mean, the president's authority is limited. The chief executive is limited in his role with regard to elections, except that where there is a threat to the national sovereignty of the United States, as I think that we can establish with the porous system that we have, then I think maybe the president is thinking that he will exercise some emergency powers to protect the federal elections going forward.
Yeah, that is the issue here. I mean, we all know that the Constitution says that the time, place, and manner of elections is something that is left to the states, not to the federal government. But as you brought up, there are national security reasons why we need to make sure our elections are protected and not corrupt in one way or the other. What are the big issues that we're going to see in this executive order? I mean, we have the voter ID. Will that involve anything to do with mail-in ballots?
I sure hope so. I mean, I think that there is that there really is a threat to our national sovereignty because of the great damage that left-wing billionaires have funded and that these left-wing groups have gotten enacted all over the country. And in some places, I'll just give you an example. This is so disheartening, but the Pennsylvania legislature passed a law when it allowed for universal no-excuse absentee voting, which they never had until 2020. And one of the things in that statute says that there has to be a date, and it has to be a date before the election. It has to be dated properly. It has to be a date before the election. And a ballot that doesn't have that can't be counted. Well, this case, Mark Elias and these people have litigated that over and over. And just last week got a ruling saying, oh, no, that statute can't be enforced. Well, if the legislatures can't enact the laws that the Constitution says it can, why is it that the president then is supposedly restricted under the Constitution, but even the legislatures, these judges, are throwing out duly enacted statutes? So our election statutes and the judicial review process are complete. They're completely departed from what the Constitution envisioned, and I think
great
that
point.
It's our job to try to get back to it.
Yeah, great point. If the legislators are not able to legislate, then who is? I mean, you would think from the actions of some of these judges that they think they are. All right, we've got less than a minute, Cleta. What would your advice be to the president if you were giving it to him to ensure that eligible voters are voting?
I would say that I would take that responsibility that the Obama administration did on their way out the door in 2017, saying that elections are critical infrastructure, and I would task the Department of Homeland Security with going through and exercising its authority to issue regulations that will secure our elections to protect the security of the homeland. Now that the left decided that elections are critical infrastructure, fine. Let's act on that and protect the integrity
right.
of our elections.
Thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Always great to have you on, founder of the Election Integrity Network. Blessings to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Jody.
All right, coming up, the Trump administration may be declaring a housing emergency this fall. Well, what does all that mean? Well, we'll discuss it next. Stay with us.
Family Research Council is committed to advancing faith, family, and freedom from the East Coast to the West. So FRC is going to Southern California for this year's Pray, Vote, Stand Summit, October 17th and 18th at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills. Join us for this powerful gathering of Christians desiring cultural renewal and spiritual revival. The Pray Vote Stand Summit brings together Christian leaders, issue experts, and government officials for a time of prayer, inspiration, and action. Together, we will seek God's guidance for our nation and engage in meaningful discussions on the intersection of faith, government, and culture. If the spiritual foundations and the cultural walls of our nation are to be rebuilt, we all have a role to play. May we each find our place on the wall as we build for biblical truth. Register now at prayvotestand.org. That's prayvotestand.org.
Jennifer, it's so exciting to be here with you today talking about our new book, Embracing God's Design. Who is actually going to benefit from reading this book in your view?
There are so many different audiences that can benefit. The first one are counselors themselves, right? Because we have some material in there where we really address the gender dysphoria diagnosis and what is wrong with it. We have information for people who are wanting to go back to embracing God's design for their life.
This is really magical to have the therapist and the individual who suffered come together and write about why this is happening and why we're seeing this.
And we brought all of that experience to the table. We want to see people walking in the fullness of who God has called them to be and not a false identity.
Order today at embracethedesign.com.
How should Christians think about the thorny issues shaping our culture? How should Christians address deceitful ideas like transgenderism, critical theory, or assisted suicide? How can Christians navigate raising children in a broken culture, the war on gender roles, or rebuilding our once great nation? Outstanding is a podcast from the Washington Stand dedicated to these critical conversations. Outstanding seeks to tear down what our corrupt culture lifts up with an aim to take every thought and every idea captive to the obedience of Christ. Whether policies or partisan politics, whether conflict in America or conflict abroad, join us and our guests as we examine the headlines through the lens of Scripture and explore how Christians can faithfully exalt Christ in all of life. Follow Outstanding on your favorite podcast app and look for new episodes each week.
Thank you so much for joining us on Washington Watch. Welcome back. I'm Jody Heiss filling in today for Tony. All right, don't forget our upcoming Pray Vote Stand Summit is going to be in Chino Hills, California on October 17th and 18th. To register or find out more information immediately following the show, go check it out, prayvotestand.org. And then real quickly, I just want to say this one more time. Imagine a state-of-the-art digital community where you are able to stay informed, stay connected with both like-minded believers and with the news happening all around our nation and our world, and you're able to stay connected from a biblical worldview perspective. Friends, that's what you get with the Stand Firm app. If you don't have Stand Firm, I'd want to urge you, go check it out and download this. It's free. It's all for your taking. Just text the word app, APP, text app to 67742. All right. The Trump administration is considering the idea of declaring a national housing emergency this fall. Now, that's something that has not been done since 2008, back in the recession. But Treasury Secretary Bessent actually kind of made this public in an interview yesterday with the Washington Examiner. And given the current state of the economy, you know, what can we make of this kind of potential move, even the consideration of it? Just want to go deeper into all of this. And joining me now to discuss it, Dr. Jason Sorens. He's a senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Dr. Sorens, welcome to Washington Watch. It's great to have you.
Good evening, Congressman. Great to be here.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us. All right. First of all, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of people who are probably asking right now, what does a national emergency declaration do? So why don't we start there?
Well, it's unclear exactly what the Trump administration is planning to do with this. We did hear from Secretary Bessent that it could involve carved out tariff exemptions on construction materials. He also mentioned standardizing zoning and building codes. Basically, the declaration of an emergency is meant to allow for more freedom of executive action on these issues without congressional authorization. But to make permanent changes here, some of the things that he'd want to do, for example, on zoning and building codes, which are largely a state matter, but there is some federal role here, to do anything permanent there, you'd need congressional authorization.
All right, so with that then, I guess the next question would be, we're talking about a potential housing emergency. So does the U.S. have a housing crisis, in your opinion?
I would say we definitely have a housing crunch. I don't like to use the word crisis about lots of things because politicians often use that term to kind of gin up support for government getting bigger. But I think in this case, the housing crunch has been caused by government. So government rules that limit your ability to build on your own land, even when you're not causing any harms to your neighbors. And so it's become a big issue for Americans, the rising cost of housing. And again, that's being caused by growing demand for housing at the same time that we have limited supply. So we definitely should think about government finding ways to roll back those regulations and unleash our construction industry to solve this problem for Americans.
I guess the definition between a crunch and a crisis all depends on your situation. One person's crunch might be another person's crisis. But now that we have the Secretary, Treasury Secretary, let the cat out of the bag, so to speak, he did not provide much detail. So here we are, we're kind of left to extrapolate all of this. So what do you think might be some actions that President Trump could take?
So exempting some of the tariffs on construction materials would definitely help. Lumber has overall risen in price, although it's come down very dramatically in the last couple of weeks. Lumber is, of course, a major input into housing. Steel, of course, was hit with a 50% tariff. It's also a major input into larger buildings. So that is something that could be helpful if we get some temporary reprieve from those tariffs. We can also look at the National Manufactured Housing Code. So this is defined by the federal government, and it includes things like requiring manufactured houses, what are sometimes known as mobile homes, to have a permanent chassis. That's something that adds to the cost of a mobile home. Usually people don't actually want to move their manufactured house around. They just want to put it on a foundation and live in it. So there's no need for them to be required to have this chassis. It's something that housing advocates have talked about for a long time. It's a deregulation move. Unfortunately, that is defined in statute. That means that only Congress can really change that particular provision. But anything we can do to roll back taxes and regulations that drive up the cost of housing is going to help Americans at the end of the day.
Good point. All right, Dr. Schwartz, if I can switch gears with you a little bit. This past Friday, a federal appeals court ruled that most of President Trump's tariffs are illegal. So what can you tell us about that ruling, and what does it mean really for tariffs in the long run?
So the so-called reciprocal or Liberation Day tariffs were issued under the authorization of an act called the IEEPA, which doesn't actually mention tariffs, but it gives the president broad emergency authority. And what the plaintiffs in this case said was, well, the Constitution gives Congress the power to tax, including the power to tax imports. And so really, you need an explicit declaration from Congress that the executive has this authority over tariffs for them to be able to do this. And the court ruled that no such explicit delegation of power has been made under the IEEPA. So these tariffs are illegal. And the case is going to the Supreme Court, most likely. We'll see if the Supreme Court agrees to take the case. The tariffs remain in effect until mid-October, and the Trump administration is pushing now for the Supreme Court to hear an appeal quickly.
So do you think the president could turn around and declare an emergency and proceed?
Well, that's what he has done, and the court has ruled, well, you can't just do anything you want under color of an emergency. So the emergency declaration was based on fentanyl coming over the border. What some critics have pointed out is that, of course, fentanyl isn't coming from Switzerland, for example, which is one of the countries hit with some of the highest tariffs. And so there's really also not really a connection between the logic of the emergency declaration and the remedy proposed. Trade deficits have been mentioned, but trade deficits have been going on for decades. So it's also unclear that they constitute an emergency. Really, if the court does strike these down, I expect the Trump administration to come back and reenact a lot of these tariffs using other authorities, because Congress has explicitly delegated to the president unilateral tariff-making authority under various other provisions, such as anti-dumping law. So that's what I expect to happen if the Trump administration loses this case.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that, because wouldn't you agree that there have been a lot of benefits that have come from the change in tariffs? I mean, it's moving things in a positive direction, isn't it?
Well, I'm a free market economist, and so I believe in free trade, and that whenever the government taxes some products more than others, it's going to distort the economy. In particular, it seems to be hitting American manufacturers who have to use imported goods to make stuff. So our advanced manufacturers are hurting when they have to pay high tariffs on things like steel and aluminum that they use in their products. So car manufacturers, aircraft manufacturers, laser manufacturers, they're being hit by taxes on their inputs, and they're also being able to sell less abroad as a result of these tariffs. So I do think tariffs are bad policy, but let's have that debate. And this is something that, you know, conservatives have been debating among themselves, and I think we should continue to have a healthy debate as the evidence rolls in.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jason Soren, Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Great information. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. As before we go, I want to bring in Mark Tapscott with the Washington Stand. He's our Senior Congressional Analyst. Mark, thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch.
Great to be here, Jody. How are you?
I am doing well. Great to see you. All right, let's continue this discussion. Congress is coming back. They're all walking in the Capitol, even as we speak right now. A lot on their plates over the next few days and months, not the least of which is the economy, is the budget. Give us a 30,000-foot perspective on what they're going to be dealing with.
A 30,000-foot perspective might be very similar to jumping out of the airplane and seeing where you land with the budget.
I have a parachute.
Yeah, well, you're fortunate. The problem is Congress has not passed the 12 major appropriations bills that need to be passed by September 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year. They come back from the August recess. They have, I think, 9 in the Senate and 10 in the House that have to be passed. And if they don't pass them, they will end up with yet another continuing resolution, which, of course, is that big, fat monstrosity that nobody knows what it is when they vote for it. And then we later find out that it was full of things that most of us don't like. So that's the basic issue. And it looks pretty grim at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It's been forever. I know when I was there, we dealt with this over and over and over, year after year after year, and we'd always land back on a continuing resolution that basically is status quo. I would think under the current administration and leadership that we would at least have a chance of actually getting some budget legislation across the finish line. Are you saying that, in your opinion, that's pretty doubtful?
Well, I think it's it's always doubtful with Congress on the budget, but I think they have made some progress. I think 9 of the 12 bills in the House have passed through the subcommittee and been reported to the main committee, and they'll end up at the, on the floor, or most of them will. But then even once they pass the House and the Senate, you still have to resolve the differences between them, which I'm sure you served on conference committees at one time or another during your tenure. And that's a pretty thorny process to, as well. So it's going to be tough. I think Speaker Johnson is probably the guy who is most suited to bringing some order out of all of this chaos. I'm not so sure about the Senate. If we do have a shutdown, it will be called the Schumer shutdown, and justly so. So we'll see.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because it is true. The House has done a relatively good job in getting some of the, those different things passed. The Senate, as usual, is just slowing everything down. So let me ask you this. We have a lot of fiscal conservatives on the right that have been doing, it appears to me at least, everything they can to try to move our whole budget and the process further to the right, looking at $37 trillion of debt. They're trying to move the needle. Are they being successful in that, in your opinion?
You know, it's two steps forward here, one step forward back, and one step sideways on the budget reform issues. Interesting that you bring that up because I'm working on a story now about there is a move, which you're probably familiar with. The $36 trillion figure for the national debt actually is a very specialized measurement that is used only by the government. If we accounted the government the same way we require General Motors or your corner grocery store to account, the actual national debt is more like $150 trillion. And the first step towards getting through a problem is to admit that you've got it. And one of the biggest problems that we have in the budget is nobody knows for sure how much we really do owe who, and we've got to get a handle on that.
Wow. That is stunning information. You've been covering Congress and Capitol Hill for a long time. Do you think they're going to be able to get anywhere? Do you sense anything different now than what you've seen over the years that you've been covering?
I tell you, Jody, that is a question that I ask myself pretty regularly because, as I think you and I have discussed, I first came to Washington as a President Reagan appointee and then became a journalist. And things are very different today, but I sense a very optimistic surge with a lot of people. There's an awful lot of people in this town that recognize the way we've been doing it for the last 30 years is just not working. And there's a lot of differences that have to be resolved, and I have a lot of confidence that in the long run, the American system is going to work, especially as we seek the Lord's guidance in all of this. Because after all, the country that prays together is going to ultimately pay off its bills and prosper together.
Yep. Well, that is, I think, I'm so glad you brought that up because that really is a great way for us to end the program today with a call on our viewers and listeners to pray. I mean, this is, Congress has their hands full. They've got their hands full. And at the heart of it all is a spiritual battle that they need the wisdom of God. We need the good hand of God to navigate us through these times, not just another piece of legislation. Mark Tapscott, Senior Congressional Analyst at the Washington Stand, thank you for joining us. Friends, that wraps up this edition of Washington Watch. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope you have a fantastic evening. We'll see you again tomorrow right here on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.